Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by MUBI, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. That is the smooth sound. Rowan, with me today, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello.
And the ever nubile Bill Graham.
Oh no.
I thought we were done with this.
This is, I guess you'd call it an inside joke from our Slack channel. And I promised our Slack people that I would call Bill Graham nubile, so he's getting called nubile.
We need to shut this down right now.
Nope. T-shirts are coming for anyone out there in listener land who doesn't understand what the hell we're talking about. I mean, if you're not given to our Patreon at patreon.com/thefilmstageshow and part of our exclusive listener host Slack channel, I just don't know what to do for you. Because I'm not about to explain it, because it is a long, dumb story. All right. Anyway, so we're here to talk about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. This is the new film from writer-director Martin McDonagh, who has previously done In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. Before we get into that, all the usual stuff. As we already said, give it to our Patreon, patreon.com/filmstageshow, and you will get access to our Slack channel. Different raffles and stuff for cool movie giveaways, and you'll also get the great sense of satisfaction that only comes from helping us produce more of these shows. We're currently getting enough off of our Patreon that you're going to start getting extra episodes in your feeds, even if you don't give to the Patreon. And those are going to be classic movie reviews. What do we mean when we say classic? There has been some questions related to that. We don't really know. So, basically, anything before we started making this podcast. I don't remember exactly what year that was, and I'm not about to go find out, because I'm trying not to have another existential crisis on this show. So, yeah. Also, you can find us online, twitter.com/filmstageshow, facebook.com/thefilmstageshow, email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com, find us on iTunes, give us a comment and a rating, and, of course, we are brought to you by the fine folks at MUBI, the streaming online cinema, where every day they introduce a new great film for you to watch. You have 30 days to watch, meaning you always have a constantly rotating selection of 30 films to look at. Coming up, MUBI's got Irma Vep coming. I feel like this has gotten a lot of talk on this show, but I think it was all from Nick Newman. So, Olivier Assayas and Maggie Chung's metacritical modern classic, metacinematic modern classic. And then this is actually part of a thing that they're doing with Mondo, who makes all those cool posters that everyone loves. You can get an exclusive poster of your own for free by referring new cinephiles to MUBI. So check it out, and you may get a free poster from Mondo. And how do you do that? How do you check it out? Go to mubi.com/filmstage and you can get a free 30-day trial. Again, that is mubi.com/filmstage. There's also a movie coming. And I want to spend some time talking about this. It is called Wet Woman in the Wind.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I'm going to just read the copy.
Speaking of nubile.
Yeah. You got that right. This is a 2016 film.
Self-awareness is out the window.
Nikatsu is rebooting its legendary Roman porno series, giving different directors creative freedom in exchange for thriftiness and a healthy dose. Is Kiko Shioda's slapstick comedy a breezy, playful delight? So if you and your lover are feeling nubile, you can go on MUBI.
Oh my god!
And you can check out Wet Woman in the Wind, which will be coming on there shortly. Giving you all the best nubile films.
No,
perhaps we should
stop.
Call them mubile. No, we shouldn't. Anyway, mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. So that's that. We could do a whole roundup of all the new people who've been accused of sexual assault and harassment since the last time we spoke to you, but we do want to be able to talk about the movie at some point. So I'll just say that life is still sucks. Like, you know, they're trying to pass a calamitous tax bill. Trump probably did a lot of illegal stuff on his way to the White House. And we're just like, the shitty thing is that, like, none of it was stopped beforehand. So now
swimming.
We're just sweeping it up. We're just
as Pixar, you know, reminds us, just keep swimming.
Yes.
Just keep swimming.
Thank you.
Because we're drowning, is what you're saying.
Yes.
If we stop, we will die like a shark.
Yes, we are not the creature from Shape of Water. We have to breathe air. So yeah.
Does it?
You're not.
You know what? We're not talking about The Shape of Water. I don't want to.
No,
wanna.
We're not. Not yet.
Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Like I said, the newest film from writer-director Martin McDonagh. It stars Frances McDormand, Woody Harrelson, and Sam Rockwell, amongst many, many other great actors. Here is the trailer.
So, Mildred Hayes, why did you put up these billboards?
My daughter Angela was murdered 7 months ago. It seems to me the police department is too busy torturing black folks to solve actual crime.
The hell is this?
Dixon, I'm in the middle of my goddamn Easter dinner. Sorry, kids.
I know, Chief, but I think we got kind of a problem. Sunshine
beating on a good time. I'd do anything to catch your
daughter's killer.
I don't think those billboards is very fair.
The time it took you to get out here whining like a bitch, Willoughby. Some other poor girl's probably out there being butchered right now.
We've had two official complaints about those billboards.
From who?
A lady with a funny eye.
A lady with a funny fucking eye?
And a fat dentist.
It's a lot of good friends.
All right, so that is the trailer for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And this is what it's about before we get into it. So, Frances McDormand. Did I say that right? I feel like I really fucked that up. Frances McDormand.
McDormand.
Not Dermot Mulroney. Not Dylan McDermott.
Yes.
Frances McDormand.
Oh my God.
Plays Mildred Jesus. Hayes, whose daughter about 7 months ago was murdered, raped and set on fire. And she is currently renting three billboards that talk about her daughter's death and ask the police chief of the town why there have still been no arrests. This is her attempt to keep the case in the public eye and force some sense of responsibility on the police. But the billboards start to rile up her small town in ways both expected and unexpected. So here we are, here to talk about it. Martin McDonagh, his previous films have been wry, dark comedies, and this one from its trailers seemed to be towing the same territory. Let's see what it was. Michael Snydell.
I enjoy Martin McDonagh to a point. In Bruges is probably one of my favorite films of the decade. Seven Psychopaths I was very mixed on. Three Billboards I think has a couple very good performances, headlining a very mediocre movie. I know that I'm in the minority with this one. So I guess the best place to start is Frances McDormand. I mean, Frances McDormand deserves every bit of awards conversation, or excuse me, every bit of attention for this performance. I mean, she's nothing short of a tornado in this. And, and you know, you also have in kind of the other lead. And all of these performances are individually interesting on their own, but I don't think McDonagh has a good hold on this material. I think that Tone of Whiplash is kind of his MO at this point, whether you point to In Bruges or Seven Psychopaths. Like, both of those films had characters who you know, went from soliloquies to just like bizarre breakdowns at a moment's notice. And that's part of the charm to McDonald's worldview and his writing. But I just don't think this movie works at all. I think that it lacks a sense of perspective and a sense of grounding that a lot of his work has. I thought that the dialogue here felt provocative in a way that felt obnoxious instead of interesting or entertaining here. I think that on some ideological levels, I think that McDonough chooses to focus on one thing at the expense of others. I don't want to take this particular thing too far, but I think Alison Wilmore wrote really fantastically about this weekend. Actually, she just did a piece describing about how this is a great film about sexism, but a pretty terrible film about racism. I think that every time
from beginning to end, I will say that if there's criticisms of that McDonough focuses on one thing over another, I will say that people are complicated. And because of the situation that this film with unlikely supporters, people that you may not want to stand next to in normal circumstances, this sort of small town life in a lot of ways, I've, you know, had some experiences in America, as I'm sure a lot of other people have, and you will find charming people that will also turn around and say some things that just make you want to run the other direction. And I think this film kind of finds that bad ways. Whether it's Frances McDormand, who plays a very complicated and multi-layered character that frankly at times is an asshole with this town. A lot of characters revolve around her. She is kind of the sun in this film, and it's interesting to see how people kind of bounce off of her and just kind of gravitate towards her in a lot of ways. That being said, I think the performances across the board are all fantastic. Changed probably from criticism to criticism of this film. I think it's been uniformly kind of in that regard. I would also say that the music is actually particularly good. I enjoyed what McDonough is doing with the music, whether it's kind of having a folksy kind of tone to it and things like that. If you listen to the lyrics as well, a lot of them are kind of interesting how they weave into the story. The hang up for me on this film is probably just simply going to be who you can recommend this to and who you can't, because this A doesn't necessarily have a lighthearted touch like a lot of his other films have. I haven't seen Seven Psychopaths. I'm not familiar enough with McDonough's back catalog to know how many other films he actually has directed, but In Bruges is hilarious from beginning to end. This film is relatively funny, I would say. It is not hilarious overall. In Bruges was definitely a dark comedy. This film, I think, is more of just a dark drama, and it's got some light touches of humor here and there. There's a lot of really good things. It's getting some recognition. Beyond that, I think I'm interested to see what everybody else thinks about this film.
Yeah, I loved this film. This was a funny, insightful, surprising, heart-wrenching, devastating, well written, well acted, well shot story. I don't know. I guess I don't understand why people would give it short shrift for tackling concepts of sexism. I don't think it really narrows in on anything in particular, aside from, I feel like this is a very specific story. So anything that doesn't fit perfectly within it is not so much relegated to the sidelines as just denied the spotlight. So I don't have a problem with it not tackling every issue under the sun. I think that the allusions that it makes and the glimpses that it gives you to the lives of these people outside of this one incident and this one conflict they have are really interesting. I wouldn't mind, you know, not sincerely, but like if McDonough wanted to revisit these characters, I'd be totally interested to see like a whole other section of this town, getting some of the tertiary characters from this and giving them a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern type spin. But I mean, for what it's doing, it's great. McDormand is wonderful.
There you go.
Yeah, Harrelson is fantastic. Rockwell is great. John Hawks, he's awesome. Abby Cornish
what's her face? Or Manchester from the sea?
Yeah, Lucas Hedges.
Of the sea or by?
By.
By the sea. Yeah.
Lucas Hedges is great in this, as is Zeljko Ivanic, who...
I love him.
Yeah, I have loved him since Homicide: Life on the Street, and he continues to do stellar work here. He's been in every McDonagh movie.
In Damages. That's how I got to know him.
Yeah, he's a great character actor who I'm always happy to see hanging around in whatever media I am consuming. And... my computer is being incredibly slow, and Clark steps on, I think, as Penelope, and Peter Dinklage in a very minor role, and we get Caleb Landry Jones finally not playing a weird guy.
He's got some aw shucks about him in this movie,
and it's really good. And you know, everyone is this is true in all life, and everyone has their moments of grace and goodness, and on some people, those moments outweigh others, and on other people, he pulls reverse. You know, it's we have this concept of people in the world, isn't? It's just not the case that is so. Anyone who has like a shitty outlook on something, or you know, is a fascist, can still give a dollar to a homeless person. Does that make him a good person? No, but he's a person who did a good thing. He's a shitty person who did a good thing. You can't say it's a bad thing just because he's a bad person, you know? And there's this line that we're trying to, like, cross nowadays where you want to run.
Are you asking me to respond to any of these things?
I'm not speaking
I'm kind of curious.
I'm still giving my main thoughts.
I'm making sure because some of them seem aimed at some things I said. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. No, I'll wrap up and then...
No, don't wrap up. I'm just asking.
No, everyone wants to talk, apparently, and I don't want to take up any time being
Brian,
the guy who's speaking.
You know what I mean.
I sat silently for all yours, but if you want to...
God damn it.
I will wrap up by saying that that I don't think that I have... I mean, there's been some funny movies this year. I think this one gave me some of the most surprising laughs, and this one also had some of the best reactions from an audience that I've been in. And there were many scenes that nearly moved me to tears. And, you know, just as far as a basic recommendation goes, if you're looking to get out of the house and not just stare vacantly at some lights on the wall, if you really want to engage with something, this is the movie to do it. Michael Snydell, you had some responses that you'd like to go through.
No, there's not some responses. I'm just, some of the things felt like more than rhetorical. So you're right. I am being too eager. So please continue.
Well, no, I'm done. So if you as the odd man out, I would love for you to respond to what we've said or elaborate on your own.
Sure. I think that I probably did a little bit of a poor job in articulating exactly what I meant with a few of my points. And I want to get into specifically the notion that people can't be complicated. The example you gave of, someone who's a fascist in their own life also, giving to a homeless person or, whatever example you want to use there. Mm-hmm. I think that is not what some people are reacting to or what I'm reacting to. I think it's rather that the shifts that happen in this movie felt like clockwork to me. Like there was an exact point where I knew some sort of redemption was coming from someone. Like, okay, we have drilled down enough into why this person is flawed, or in some cases just a terrible person. So we need to redeem them in some points. And that's what I reacted to that I didn't find in something like In Bruges or even Seven Psychopaths. I think that – so in the case of In Bruges, I think the reason why a lot of the weird tonal stuff works for me is the whole thing kind of feels like they're stuck in purgatory for the whole time.
Yeah, I was about to say, is it because they're actually in Bruges and like the rules just don't seem to apply in Belgium?
No, I mean that's like totally a thing. For me. And I think there's something about how Ebbing, Missouri is presented here that feels very false and feels extremely overwritten to me, to the point that when all of the things fall into place and, the way that some of these characters, they come in with clockwork, and then there are some characters then. I mean, you guys briefly already mentioned Abby Cornish. And I would really like to speak about at least two other female characters who I think are truly given awful, awful parts. And like, I can't ignore the fact that I think that, McDonough is much better at writing male characters than female characters. And that is something that bothers me, other than Frances McDormand, who I don't think is given a particularly interesting character, but is such an amazing presence that she makes the movie for me.
I am so super curious as to why you think she's not given an interesting character.
I think that there is a too much softening. I think this is oddly, this is weird to say when this is a movie that revels in not being PC and loves saying fuck. I love saying fuck too. So I can sympathize in a way. I think this movie is oddly polite. I think it is oddly too nice. And
that is insane. Okay.
I know. Yeah. But I guess when I mean polite, I guess I mean neat. I mean that even the times when this tries to make twists, it still has to soften characters. Sorry, I guess I kind of need to be specific about two different examples. So I guess I'll wait there. But I guess
for spoilers.
That's what I specifically react to, is this felt programmatic and constantly like encapsulating why I think McDonald's a better writer than a director. I think that there are, oh God, that's spoilers too. All right. I just wanted to speak briefly to the idea that people can't be complicated. That's all I wanted to respond to at the moment.
And your response to that is they can be?
No, that it can be. It's the rhythms and patterns to which like new information comes up.
Okay.
Okay.
It's going to be difficult to talk about without getting into spoilers.
I understand that now. Yeah.
I don't know what to say then. Is there anything non-spoiler that we'd like to talk about before we jump into the spoiler section?
I don't know. I just want to praise Woody Harrelson up front. I don't think we've mentioned his name enough, and I feel like his character needs to get a lot of like love because it's hilarious what they keep doing with his character.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point because from that trailer, you can kind of get a feeling for like the way that this movie could be. But I think that, again, one of the strengths of McDonough's writing and his directing and the way the movie is edited and everything is the fact that, you know, it's not about like a crusading mother who loved her daughter looking for justice and the unfeeling police chief who doesn't give a shit.
Exactly.
Yeah, like he cares, but like his powers are limited, you know, and this is something you kind of see a lot in movies about cops. But I feel like it's done a lot differently here. Because
it's given a different edge, I think, because of the situations kind of revolving around it, but also just simply because their hands in a lot of ways are kind of tied and they can only do so much. But also it delves into too much spoiler to kind of touch on this in that way. But like, we find out a lot of information that we don't necessarily know from the outset. So this film doesn't do one of those, oh, you just like never know. No, like it uncovers a lot of stones and it does a decent amount of work to basically lay out the fact that this police state or this police force might have expended its resources to the point where it literally cannot solve this situation.
Yeah.
So,
and usually in a movie where that is like the case, the police, you know, will go up to the mother's house and be like, I'm sorry, but we can't find anything. The trail has gone cold. And then she'll cry and they'll be like, you know what? I'm going to figure it out. But in this case, you know, they've just kind of moved on because they can't do anything. And Frances McDormand is McDormand is furious and begins a campaign to make sure that they can't forget about what she is owed. And, you know, as the movie goes on, you see that like her anger is not just directed at the police. It's all over the place. You know, herself, sure. Her daughter, her husband,
her ex,
like everything.
Yes.
Yeah. And, yes. And I think that extra like seven layers, makes this, you know, a particularly interesting character study as well as a study of human nature in general.
And I'm not even sure if it's necessarily the way that McDonough directs, or it's just simply the characters that he's created and the kind of storyline that he's made. I'm not sure that this film is necessarily particularly well directed, but what is on screen now? I'll be upfront. I was sent a screener of this, so I have the script, but that script is not going to be what they actually shot. That's going to be their final kind of like version of that script. So it's going to have a lot of details added into it that may not have been in the original script that he started shooting with, if that makes sense. So I don't know if a lot of these kind of cute touches that are just, to my mind, absolutely brilliant and really kind of sell this film as something other than a lot of things that you've seen before was in the script to begin with, or if that's a directing kind of choice that he made maybe in the edit and situations like that. That gets into a really fine detail of like, it's tough to slice writer directors in half and be like, oh, well, this is his writing that's showing through, or this is his directing showing through. It's tough because they're the fucking same person. So, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, you know,
can you imagine like Steven Soderbergh, who's also shooting his goddamn film and just like, God damn.
Yeah. Cause then
like,
you can't even say, well,
I don't even know.
By...
No. Yeah. And it's like, you asshole.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as a director, you are the one making choices. You're where the buck stops. So I think every good thing in the movie, you know, you have to give to the director in some way. You know, he is the one who modulates the performance, usually makes the last call on which cut they use. You know, he passes off on basically everything. yeah, I mean, so I think that if, you know, it's easier to call out glaring flaws than it is to just call out, you know, this movie isn't Scorsese. He's not doing a lot of tricky, interesting things with a lot of kineticism. But I think that in terms of, you know, blocking and making sure that spatially it all makes sense, and then getting a good rhythm from his performers who are playing off of each other. I mean, yeah, I think he does a fine job.
I want to mention one kind of particular cinematic thing that they do in this film that you can kind of get a clue in on the trailers and things like that have been around, is the reveal of what the billboards actually say and things like that. I thought was just particularly flawless. I really enjoyed Sam Rockwell's performance and how it doles out information and how he's just such a bumbling idiot and keeps cursing at these people that are just like, I don't know, man, just read the other billboard. keeps going down and down. It's brilliant the way that they kind of disseminate information in that particular sequence.
Yeah, yeah. I think that sequence in particular was when I was like really on board with the film, and it didn't lose me throughout. So let's get into spoilers so that Michael can talk again. we're gonna dive in. This is gonna be where all the conflict happens.
The podcast and the film.
Yes. Well, I mean, conflict is almost immediate in the film, but for us, it's going to definitely be in the spoiler section. Hear the spoilers. Don't listen any further if you don't want to get spoiled on the movie. Turn off your podcast player. Take out your headphones. Throw it against a wall. Okay. So, Michael Snydell, you had been talking about some of the issues that you had. You had two characters in specific who you said evinced a flaw that you saw in this movie, but you needed to wait for spoilers. So now is your time.
Give me a second so I can remember what I was talking about. All right.
I'm going to assume that one of them was Penelope.
Let me look up who Penelope is.
The new, the 19-year-old zoo worker?
You would be right, because she certainly has the absolute worst scene in the entire movie. That whole argument where John Hawks and Frances McDormand are having an argument that then he flips the table over and puts her against the wall. And then she comes in and starts doing this incredibly irritating monologue that's gross, to say the least. Let me put it that way. I mention that specifically because I think those scenes are more representative of what this movie actually is, which is this bizarre meld of like prestige overacting, like that scene of John Hawks and Frances McDormand right then, and then cutting right to almost like slapstick idiocy with Penelope's character. And it's that rhythm that is so grating to me. And I think the movie goes back to it over and over and over again. And when you combine that with the ways that it won't actually have these characters allowed to actually be completely bad. You guys are talking about Woody Harrelson. I think Woody Harrelson's fine in this movie, but I think that the inclusion of his character decenters Frances McDormand. I think that since we're in spoilers, he dies about an hour into the movie, I would say.
Yes.
And
he kills
himself, I think
we should say
yes, he kills himself in the stables after he has a wonderful final day with Abby Cornish's character, who for some reason has an accent. And I think that Woody Harrelson's character is a major problem in this, because I think that by consistently reminding that he has cancer and Frances can't actually fully have her convictions, like she has to, you know, like modulate how she's talking to him. And that's potentially interesting, except for the fact that I don't think that John McDonough's his brother. Martin McDonough doles out these things with any any kind of grace or doing it in a way that doesn't feel telegraphed from a mile away from me. I'd say similarly about Sam Rockwell's character.
Well, okay. Hold on. Because we have to start at some point. And so if you just keep going and going and going.
I've made a list. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So if you're touching on Woody Harrelson's character and the way that she kind of treats him, I think she's treating him with a deft hand simply because she knows that he is the smartest person on that police force. He's on his last legs, yes, but she does not put a blunt edge on that because she specifically calls him out on the billboards. And when he says, "Hey, did you realize I'm dying from cancer?" She's like, "Yeah. I don't give a shit."
She even says that she's doing it now specifically because it won't be as impactful when he's dead.
Exactly. So she knows that she's dealing with someone that has the ability to actually put forth the effort and potentially solve this case. All right. Or at the very least, kick that can down the alleyway to eventually being solved. It's not without his participation that this situation more than likely in her mind is going to get solved. She mentions to John Hawks that she's read a bunch of books about how to get cases solved. And this is all part of her play. So as wild and crazy as she kind of seems at times, she also has a lot of like research behind her and she's thinking a lot of this stuff through. Now, at a certain point in this film, she kind of crests that hill and hits no man's land where she's not coming back. And that particular moment is when she starts the fucking Molotov cocktail the police station. You don't come back from that situation. But this character in this film finds a way to kind of sneakily raccoon its way out of that. Just the same, I think she is never blunted edge with Woody Harrelson's character at any point. I think she's treating him, like I said, as the smartest person that could potentially solve this case or bring about that means. And so she's treating him like a human because she probably doesn't have that much against him except for the fact that it seems like this case has completely stalled out and she hasn't been given a good enough reason. And it is 7 months after this situation has happened, from what I can understand. It sounds like she's just a grieving mom and she wants justice before anyone can actually give it to her in this particular case. And so
she's basically fighting against like the gods of chance because, as he tells her in his letter to her after he has passed, you know, if you don't solve it immediately, odds are that a case is going to get solved down the line when the guy does something else and his DNA gets in the system, or he's like talking about it in prison or in a bar. And like, but she's not willing to accept that because she can't, because as we see, the reason that her daughter was out walking alone is because she refused to let her borrow the car. Or, you know, get it and they got into a fight. And instead of even like calling for a cab, the daughter's just like, "All right, I'm going to walk. I hope I get raped."
Holy shit. That flashback, by the way,
that
flashback is unbelievably terrible. Like it is just some of the worst writing I've seen all year is how on the nose that flashback.
Are you
was.
Serious?
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
I have sat through arguments like that. Like when people like I have been in the position of the brother in that where like, two people who are warring just forget that you're in the room.
That is the one scene
shit to you.
That is the one scene with her. Lucas Hedges is very good in this. He gets an interesting character. He gets to act like a human being. The one scene you get with the girl is her going on a temper tantrum and then saying, I hope you get raped, as you said. Like, it is terrible. Writing.
That's not terrible. That I don't understand why that's terrible writing.
No, that is ridiculous. Like, no idea how to write its female characters and all. And that's extremely annoying to me. Like, the very fact that, like, this is not really about Frances McDormand. Like, it's about all these other dipshits that we spend so much time with.
What are you talking about? What, like, I can't even understand where you're coming from right now. This is 100% about Frances McDormand. It is about Mildred as a character. Because you go through this, and she seems like a mama bear who wants to find her daughter's killer, and, like, you have this feeling... That she
no, is, it is about the redemption of these dudes.
It's not
about her.
It's what it is totally not. It is about a woman who is trying to undo the mistakes that she's made past the point where they can be saved. And so she's doing it by lashing out and hurting everyone else around her, which is what she's been doing for a while, apparently. Like, this isn't a woman who was baking cookies and taking her daughter to Girl Scouts and fucking riding kids to the soccer practice before her daughter died. And now she's turned into this, like, hellion in a good way. But, like, she has always been this way. And now she has what she believes to be a full right to continue acting like this and hurt people and be a dick. Like, you hear the way that she talks to her daughter. And suddenly you think about when she was talking to the priest, when she was talking to Woody Harrelson, when she was talking to everyone else. And you're like, oh,
I know, and I
she's not broken. This is who she is. And she's just doing more of it now because now there's not anything to hold her back.
And in every single case, I don't see a character. I see McDonough's mouthpiece and his fucking dialogue where he feels the need to say fuck every 2 seconds. Like, I don't see people in any of those characters. I think where she rants out the priest is just like all of that stuff. All right. Shit, I didn't think I was mad about this. Here we go, apparently.
It's mother all over again. I mean, I just... It's a movie, and it's a movie written by a playwright, and so, like, half the reason I come to a movie like this is for dialogue that no one would ever speak aloud in real life, because you're not clever enough in the moment to do that. But that's what movies and books and plays and television are for. There has never been a person who could extemporaneously give an ad pitch like Don Draper. You know,
why the fuck did we both go to him?
Because he's the man. I don't know.
Yes,
you know,
I don't know.
And
that's incredible.
And no one has ever been as glaringly, vulgarly menacing as Al Swearengen, you know, and no White House spokesperson has ever been as, like, dead on and deft as CJ Craig in The West Wing. But, like, that's why we come to these things, to see people who are like that. And as long as their character is consistent, then you should be able to excuse whatever flowery language that we're there for, because that's why we're there. Because I guarantee that, you know, if this situation were happening in the real world, the people having these conversations would be 10 times more vulgar, but say 3 times less stuff.
Well, I think for whatever case, this is the point where flowery indulgences is not something I can excuse in this case.
Why can't
and in
you excuse
other McDonough
it,
films, it was something that, you know, I went in knowing that was going to be it. But there is something about the extremes in this film that clash too strongly for me to find some middle between, like, prestige film wannabe and, like, lurid pulp, like a gussied up revenge story. Like, there's something about those two parts,
but I don't
that
think
for
it's
whatever
trying to
reason,
be either
great.
Of those.
But that's what it felt like to me. Like, speaking again about that scene in at the dinner table in Frances McDormand's house, like, those rhythms feel like two extremes to me, place one after the other. And that's what I'm seeing over and over again in this film, is like sentimentality followed by sadism, or the opposite way.
I find it very interesting that you felt that way, because I didn't think this movie was sentimental or sadistic.
You don't think a scene where Caleb Landry Jones gives orange juice to the racist piece of shit who beats him to a pulp is not a sentimental scene?
No.
All right, well, then we'll differ there.
Yeah, I mean, like, sentimental to me is like, evocations of, like, a different time, and, like, you know, it's not quite melodrama. It's like, because melodrama is good. To me, sentimentality is like trying to reach back and take something and give it to you again. You know, sentimental has like more to do with nostalgia when I think about it, you know?
Okay.
And so for me, you know, a scene where Caleb
Landry...
Let me
substitute treacly then. Let me substitute that.
I don't think it's treacly either, but...
connotations.
I mean,
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I just, you know, to me, a scene like the one where so Caleb Landry Jones gets the shit beaten out of him and then thrown out a window by Sam Rockwell. Sam Rockwell is then in the police station when Frances McDormand firebombs it, and he gets out, but he's very badly burned. But he did save Angela's case file. And then he goes to the hospital and he gets put in Caleb Landry Jones's room, and Caleb Landry Jones is being really inviting and nice. And then he finds out that it's Sam Rockwell, and Sam Rockwell apologizes, and he becomes very angry, but he still gives him some orange juice and points the straw towards him. And I don't think that that is sentimental. I don't think that that's treacly. I don't think that it is
treacly.
It's not filled with treacle to the point of being treacly.
I'm uncomfortable now.
Nubile.
Probably.
So what I find that scene to be is, I don't know, it's human. It's like aspirational.
Yes.
Like, shouldn't we all have the grace of Caleb Landry Jones to, if not accept the apology and forgive the person, to still hand them a glass of orange juice because they're fucking on fire and in a hospital. Well, not on fire.
Yes.
He's burned. The fire has been put out by this point.
I hope he's not on fire still.
It's
That'd be
thing.
Very unfortunate if the nurse rolled him in there, he's still on fire.
Well, there was one ember and it was like a cigarette butt, and then they just no, but
let me agree with you.
Okay.
Real quick.
I'll let you speak because you're going to agree with me.
I found that scene immensely human, and part of that is just simply because humans are very complicated, and they have to understand that, look, I'm going to be dealing or in and around this person whether I want to or not. Caleb Landry Jones had this very awkward conversation with Sam Rockwell early on in the film after he found out that he was the one that that he works for the advertising agency that basically put the billboards up because they're in charge of the billboards. And they have this very awkward scene at a bar where Caleb and Peter Dinklage are playing pool, and Sam Rockwell is like openly threatening him. And it's one of those situations where you start to realize that in a very small town, you may hate the person that is sitting right across from you. And it doesn't matter. You can't put that behind you, or you have to put that behind you, because in a lot of ways, you're going to interact whether you want to or not. This situation reminds me a lot of like a small high school situation where it's just like you can't get away from the person, the bully, whoever it is that you just desperately want to get away from. So in some ways, you have to kind of extend that olive branch when the opportunity arises. And sometimes it's a shitty moment where the shitty person is burnt to a crisp and is like, hey, I'm sorry about this, what I did to you. Now, whether that apology is like real or not, I don't care. His reaction is to be pissed off, like sit down and like fucking have a moment for himself, and then just be like, we're going to be fucking sharing a hospital room for the next couple of months or however long it takes for him to like recover. Here's some fucking orange juice, dude. Like, whatever. You know? And that's what I found that situation was. It's just an further encapsulation of what this film kind of deals with is that sometimes the people that you hate the most are sometimes the people that you have to deal with in some of these small towns. And the only reason that in bigger towns you don't have that situation as arise is because you don't know you hate that person yet. You've not interacted with them. In small towns, you've interacted with them because they're the only person, the only advertising agency in that small town. Like, oh, shit. Now I don't like you. Can I go to somebody else? No, you can't. Ah, fuck. Okay. You know? Like the dentist.
God, the dentist. Well, to my mind, it's kind of beyond that. Like, you know, if someone is a piece of shit to you and someone causes you grievous harm and then they come at you with like a full-throated earnest apology, you know, they did that and you don't have to become their best friend. You don't have to do anything nice for them. But like, it's always nice to hear, you know, you could be like, well, thanks for apologizing. I still hate you. You're still a bad person. But like, maybe they're not. Like, maybe they have become better and, you know, extreme things will push you in that direction, or even just the incontrovertible flow of time. And that's what I got out of that scene, you know, like, because he doesn't, you know, he doesn't become friends with him. He just extends him like the least amount of human kindness that he can offer in particular at that moment. And that's not sentimentality, because you don't see them hanging out at the bar playing pool later. You never see them again together. You never get any indication that he and Caleb Landry are cool now. Caleb Landry Jones. I don't know why I called him by his first two names. It's you know, so I don't, Michael, does that make any sense to you?
It does, but I think where it starts to break down for me a little bit is it's not quite a bullying situation. It's literally that he almost killed him. I think it's the extent of what happened. And I think that as I think about it more, in a lot of cases, the brutality and how far that a lot of characters go. And then the fact that in some cases it's dismissed, even as you're saying that, I will admit I didn't recognize the nuance that was happening there, and I can understand what you guys are saying there. But it's, again, the fact that he almost killed him is where it – I mean, maybe he's a bad person because I don't want to give him any leeway for that. But I think the way
the only thing that I can say in his defense, which, you know, he's not a character that you want to have to defend, but like, His chief, who was like a second father, the only person in the world who seemed to believe that he could at any point ever become a good person, had just killed himself. And it was precipitated by a series of billboards that at once didn't quite defame the chief, but definitely put the onus on him. And then made him like resurrect this case that he knew that there would be no new information to be found by going out and looking for it in the normal ways that the police would work. And so like, you see the way that Sam Rockwell breaks down after receiving that news, you know, he literally fainted and then he was bawling his eyes out. And, you know, he was taking revenge in the only way that he knew how. And obviously he was wrong, because as the letter later states to him, you know, what he's got to do is, like, not react sometimes. He's just got to calm the fuck down and, like, realize that he can feel a certain way without acting on it immediately. And I think that he takes that to heart. And it might actually be, like, a situation and a piece of advice that have, like, helped him. So, you know, when he's with Caleb Landry Jones and he says that, you know, he's like, my chief had just died, and you know, Caleb Landry Jones doesn't want to have to admit that there's context behind him being an asshole, but there is context, and it's not enough to excuse it, but it is enough to at least explain it, and thus you're able to move
in a character, in a character motivation sense, certainly. You know, this guy is obviously a bumbling idiot, and even his graceful methodology of trying to get the DNA from this dude that he finds in a bar that's bragging about like raping her before she's like lit on, or while she's like drenched in gasoline.
By the way, why is his friend like, oh yeah, like why is
because he's a creepy motherfucker. They're both creepy. Like
you don't become friends with a guy like that unless you want to be friends with a guy like that.
Like your question is, why is his friend like that? My question.
No, I'm fucking around.
I'm being facetious there.
No, it's funny that you bring that up though, because like I listened to this podcast, Last Podcast on the Left. It's a great show. Listen to it. And it is really weird how like serial killers will like make friends with people and then like tell them everything and their friends are totally cool with it, and then like they just start working together, like Leonard Lake and Charles Ng. Leonard Lake was just like, yeah man, I want to like catch a girl and like turn her into my sex slave in a basement, and I've already like failed twice and had to kill him. And Charles Ng was just like, yeah, fuck it, man, that sucks, you need help. Like shitty fucking people like that exist, and it just lets you know, if you're feeling lonely, there's someone out there for everyone, so keep on trucking, buddy.
But like, okay, so my point was that he's clearly a bumbling idiot, and even his somewhat stupid idea of like, oh, I'll get this guy DNA by fucking picking a fight with him in a bar and scratching him. And in some ways it's smart, in some ways it's incredibly dumb, because the other factor is like I don't know, there's so many situations or so many things that's wrong with that situation for someone to bring forth evidence of his like DNA and as part of a ongoing investigation.
A smarter person would have just stolen the beer bottle.
Something else besides picking a fight with the dude and then like scratching him.
But I think things. Not to get into the minutiae of his plan, but I think the plan with the fight was not just to get his DNA, but also to like make sure that he left in that car.
I mean, I guess that's why he maybe taunts him at the end just to get him to fucking leave. Mm-hmm. Although he probably should have been like, hey, dude, I'm a cop at some point before.
But he's like, not anymore.
Well, that guy doesn't know that, right? And the other people there certainly recognize him as a cop.
Yeah, but he immediately says, like, where's his badge? And when he can't produce one, he kicks him some more. So I feel like – and when we
He says, where's his badge? And he says, I was kicked out the force and I can't find it, or something along those lines, which basically gives the guy carte blanche to just be like, oh, okay, well, then I'm going to kick you in the face and then run.
Well, we also find out that he is in the military.
Sure.
In some sort of special forces.
What do you guys, I meant to ask this, what do you guys make of the aforementioned scene where that guy shows up at the knick-knack store? I don't know what to call where Frances McDormand's character works. What do you guys make of that scene where he comes to confront her?
He's passing through, and I guess he watched a news report, found out who she was, went to her store and taunted her. He probably saw the billboards or the news report. And then, like I said, he was passing through. Obviously he's been there for a couple of days or something like that. I'm trying to put together like the timeline of, well, I guess he's been there for a couple of months because he's already been lit on fire and recovered. So I don't know how fast burn victims scar and then like are released to the wild. That's a terrible phrase.
Released to the wild.
I
don't know. I don't think it was a couple months. I think it was just a couple days. But what I'll say is, I mean, if the movie leads you to believe that he is not the rapist, but a rapist.
Sure.
And it is very possible that not being able to revisit his own crime, he is going out in search of a similar crime so that he can still get the kind of kick that he's looking for.
By taunting someone that basically he has no connection to and bragging about it and then feeling kind of boisterous about that. Because, maybe like you're saying, either something happened over there overseas or something happened somewhere else, but he's not stupid enough to like taunt the people there because he would quickly be connected to it. But here it's like, well, my alibi is solid, so you can't pin me for any of this stupid shit. I'm just bragging, you know? So yeah, I think he's in his mind having harmless fun in the sense that he can't be tagged to this.
Yeah. Cause people who do shit like that, they keep a memento or they revisit the scene of the crime or something. And he's
you know what I'm
doing that.
You know what I'm sensing as I hear you guys talk about this movie? I'm unable to see these characters in this film as part of a world and a place in the way that you guys can you hear me? Sorry.
Yeah.
I seemed like you dropped. I get the sense as you and Bill talk about this, that you're talking about a sense of place. You're talking about a sense of time, the changes that these characters are going through. And I was unconvinced that these characters or other characters existed in this town. And I can't articulate exactly why, but I'm realizing that many of my problems here is because all of the things I'm talking about are so disjointed and separated in my head. Like, they're not a part of any larger continuity at all. They're like very much related to this A to B to C to D script writing that I seem to be focusing on really intently for this particular script. And I'm not quite sure why that's happening. But as I think about it, I feel like that's a big problem why so many of these things don't work for me.
Michael, let me ask you something. Did you read or listen to anything ahead of the film?
Yeah, actually all positive things, weirdly. Weirdly enough. There are some really great positive reviews. All right, sorry. No, one negative review that I knew about. I'll name two, one positive review and one negative review that are out there that are just fantastic. Brian Tallarico at Roger Ebert wrote a great review, 4-star review for this. And then one negative review is Vadim Rizov at Filmmaker Magazine. So yes, I did read some things about this, but I went into this being extremely excited, and not thinking about it in this sense. I was really excited to spend time in this world to get to see Frances McDormand kick some fucking ass of some, you know, shitty people.
Are you like upset that it's not more binary? Like,
no. No,
because you were pissed off that Woody Harrelson's in the movie, and you have issues with Caleb Landry Jones giving Dixon some orange juice, and then said that you wanted to see Frances McDormand kick the ass of some shitty people.
I am being all right. When I say that, I am not saying that I wanted this to be, you know, Miss 45. I wanted this to feel a lot more spontaneous than it ended up doing. And I swear, like, I really didn't know the beats in this movie. And yet I felt like I could name the exact moment that something was going to come in that would artificially complicate that character. And I recognize that when I say artificial, that is editorialization on my part. I know.
Yeah.
That's not objective, but I'm just saying that when it came to things that would either, you know, for instance, with Sam Rockwell's character, you know, as Bill already mentioned, the point where he saves Mildred's daughter's file from the fire. Like those moments to me didn't feel
like an obvious character.
Yeah, okay. Like they felt like very writerly to me. And I think a weird thing I was also thinking about in relation to this is I was comparing it to something like Manchester by the Sea, which I didn't love as much as you guys, I know, but I was thinking then about the emotional continuity that I felt in that film and how much it was missing here and how much I didn't have a sense of what that grief looked like and how that anger manifested beyond like the plot points. I'm getting a little bit.
Well, I don't, you know, in a situation like this, there's nowhere for the anger to go. And I think that that's
part of the story. It's like a very purposefully like myopic story in a way. Like I want to be clear that I recognize what this is trying to do. And even though it's difficult sometimes as a critic, like I don't want to say I wish this was something else. Like that's not good criticism. Mm-hmm. But I can still say that, like, when I point to these different things, they don't connect for whatever reason. They are very much like stationary points that exist as individual scenes rather than a film. And now I'm just repeating myself. But
that's incredible to me. I can't even begin to see that. So it's difficult to even say. Like, well, you know, every scene follows and proceeds from the scene that came before it, and things come back, and I just don't know how to react. Well, when you say it doesn't feel like a movie, because then at the same time you go, oh, but it also feels like everything that's going to come is very predictable, and it feels too writerly like a movie.
I don't want to say it doesn't feel all right. Yeah, now I am contradicting myself.
Yeah, and okay, that means I've won.
Look, if we can't contradict ourselves, then we're not human, okay? Because feelings and our thoughts behind them are going to cross at many points. And sometimes they're just not going to fucking make sense. Like why I like The Lobster less than I like the other fucking movie that he made. And it's like, y'all pointedly asked me like why, and I was like, I don't fucking know. Like I just don't know. And both of those films revolve in a very similar orbit and have, you know, a lot of characters that are talking and acting like they're on the spectrum. And so it's just one of those situations. But that being said, if for me, anytime someone basically flat out does not like a film, I like to try and discover at what point it turned. And, you know, I've had this discussion with Brian about certain films like Logan Lucky, and, you know, where we just literally could not get him to say a positive thing about that film from beginning to end.
Sure.
And it was frustrating to be on this side of the fence and try and figure out at what point it turned on him. And so I'm curious if you can kind of think about and figure out at what point this film started to sour on you, because it sounds like it soured relatively quickly. And from that point on, I can understand once a film sours, it's hard to come back from that, especially as much as it seems to have soured in your mind, at least. And I'm curious if that was post or during.
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. I mean, interestingly enough, I probably did sour on it relatively quickly. I think very early on, even from I can speak to the first time where the dialogue didn't work for me was literally the first priest scene very early on. And I realized that like that particular like
monologuing kind of.
Yeah. Which usually excites me, and, you know, like, I was really looking forward to, like, I immediately found it juvenile in a way that I didn't previously. And I found it, I was concentrating consistently on, like, the cadence of how they were talking. And so, I mean, pretty early on, I was kind of bothered by the dialogue. Now, interestingly enough, the third act is by far my favorite part of the film.
That's crazy, because that, I feel like, is when it would lose most of the people who would have otherwise.
Sure.
Because that's when it starts to get complicated.
Well, that's when I think it gets the most interesting. As it, you know, because I think that the ways it starts sidestepping the easy answers is when it did feel like it was going a little more off the rails. So at that time, when I first saw it, I thought the third act was the most successful part because there were the least, like, amount of clunky scenes for me. Now, admittedly, in the 2+ weeks since I've seen it, I've soured on almost the whole film. I am in a position where I'm going to, within days, have to pick performances, and I can easily put up at least one or two performances from this film. As far as, like, direction, like, I was staying quiet because I really don't think this is a well-directed film. I think this shows McDonough's origins as a playwright very explicitly. I think that the most interesting image is in the title. And I do agree with you guys that the way the billboards are used, as far as the first reveal, as far as Sam Rockwell seeing them for the first time, as well as when they're on fire, I think that all of those things are, is really powerful. And even, like, allegorically, or maybe not allegorically, excuse me, in terms of how it extends to how that town responds to it. Like, I find that on paper thematically interesting, but I just found the ways that the town reacts too small. I don't know. Maybe I needed more grace notes in this movie, honestly. More things that just felt like they, I don't know.
But see,
What are you looking for from me?
I know, and we've got to wrap up, like, in 9 minutes, but, like, I find it funny that you're like, the way the town reacted was too small. And I just, like, I'm picturing the end of season one of The Leftovers and just being like, I guess that's what he wants. Like, I guess he wants fire and blood.
I always want fire and blood, let's be honest.
Well, it's funny also because, like, I thought a lot of Nora Durst from the Leftovers, the HBO TV series, played wonderfully by Carrie Coon. And in the episode in which she is first...
She's the best.
Really, like, brought to the fore. She's in a coffee shop, and Jill sees her very purposefully pushing a glass off of her table. And the person comes over and is like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, let me get you a new one. And it's this woman who has undergone a terrible tragedy, kind of like prodding the people around her because she knows that her tragedy gives her power over others. She's a triple legacy at the conference she goes to later in the series. And so that's a lot of, like I said, I kind of thought that's what this movie was doing with Frances McDormand until you kind of, like, see how she used to be. And you realize that she's just kind of turned her volume up and she hasn't really changed.
She's expanded her radar.
Yeah. She's got more now. There's a lot more that she can be mad at, but she's always been a little mad. And whether or not, you know, rightly so, who is to say? Though, from what we see, I think that more often than not, the things that she says about her own past ought to be believed. There's a lot we could talk about, but unfortunately, we've got to get going. So, let's wrap up.
Yes.
Bill and I really enjoyed this movie. Michael Snydell did not and got angry about it, so...
It's the end of the year. I'm going to have some unpopular opinions.
Yeah,
thanks for listening.
Next week we're going to talk about Lady Bird, and we're going to hurt each other's feelings and really get fucked up.
Are you sure you don't just want to review it right now, Brian? I feel like you already have some feelings about it.
Whoa. I just, like, I'm at the point now where I don't feel like I have to, like, be coy about, like, the ones I'm excited for and the ones I'm not. You know, I'm not excited for Lady Bird. Now, am I going to go see it? Yeah. Am I going to like it? Probably. Maybe. I don't know. I wasn't excited for Coco in pretty much exactly the same way I wasn't excited for Lady Bird. And I fucking loved Coco. So, like, if you make
that
movie, the odds are in your favor. I feel like that's happened.
May the odds
year,
ever be in your favor.
Yes.
Brian,
the
always.
Cinematic Hunger Games. Yep. No, I feel like that's happened a lot. And I honestly think that maybe we're just coming to a point where I've got to stop watching trailers. And I think that might remedy.
I would agree because I didn't watch a single trailer for Coco. Like, I just avoided that because I was just like, seeing that.
And then
so
you heard it on this podcast and you're like, oh God, why are they playing Jason Derulo in the background?
A little warning, avoid all Shape of Water trailers.
The second trailer I saw for that film was
spoilery
fucking,
as fuck.
Like,
I saw the first one they put out, and I haven't seen any since then.
Don't
so
see any more.
Yeah, right. I made that same choice, Brian. I was like, cool, I'm sold on this, I'm good. And then I saw a second one in a movie theater, and I was like, the fuck is happening right now? Why are they're literally showing me people like in very obviously in the third act, and I was just like, okay, so this is how they're advertising movies now. They're like, hey, don't you want to see this film that does blank and blank and blank and blank and blank, and here's the ending, you should watch it all again. It's like, no.
We recently had a movie where I feel like we all were talking about it and we're like, hey, did you realize that like the last scene was in the trailer?
Yeah.
But I can't recall which movie it was. So if anyone remembers, tweet at us.
Yes. I know exactly what you're talking about because like literally like one of the last shots was in the trailer.
Yeah,
and
I feel
you're,
like it was huge too.
Yeah. As you realize, you're just like, wow. And yeah. Okay.
Right. Bill, I was in the trailer, or I was in the theater and saw that exact trailer, and then I watched it a few days later, and I'm like, okay. This is not good.
Real
unfortunately,
tough.
I see everything in the theaters, so I gotta deal with that. Yeah. So that's all.
Did you guys know that Jordan actually puts headphones on during trailers?
I have friends who do that.
I've done that. I did that for in front of all the trailers for The Wolverine, and then I watched that movie and I was like, that was not worth the effort.
I did it. I only actively avoided trailers once, and that was for Before Midnight, because in essence, any knowledge that there was going to be a third movie was a spoiler.
Sure,
you know,
absolutely.
Because you're like, because it's a movie and it's like 10 years later, and so like literally anything that's in the trailer is going to be a spoiler, because it's like, are they even still together? Do they have more children now? Where will it take place? You know?
Spoilers, slight spoilers for Before Midnight. Yeah, Before Midnight.
I mean, I'm not spoiling anything because I didn't tell anything. But yeah, like literally, I like closed my ears, but I had heard a single voice and I was like, god damn it, now I know X.
And I don't go as far as Jordan, but I turn my eyes downward and then I will plug my ears and then just hum. And
that sounds annoying as fuck. You should just wear some earphones.
No, I don't want to wear earphones in a movie theater.
I'm surprised you haven't been kicked out of the draft house for that, Bill Graham.
Oh my god.
Okay, it is not a very loud hum. When you plug your ears, it makes plenty of noise.
My daughter, this is the last thing I'm going to say, and then I'm actually going to make us stop. My daughter has found out that if she plugs her ears, things sound different. So she'll like, I'll say something, and then she'll like plug her ears and stare at me until I say it again, and then she'll just laugh like crazy. It is that's the awesome. Cutest goddamn thing you've ever seen. So that's all for today. You can find us online at twitter.com/filmstageshow, Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Give to our Patreon, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. Give us your nubile money. Yeah. Give it to us.
Do it.
It's nubile. Let's, and then Movie's doing their things. Let's all remember the time that Movie told me that I should plug a movie called Wet Woman in the Wind. And I just like, if anyone watches this with a friend, I'd love for you to tweet at us and tell me how that went and how you broached the subject of the fact that you should watch it. Cause like, I'm curious, I guess, as to like what the hell, like, cause Blumhouse is kind of like, here's $5 million, do whatever you want. And this sounds like that, but also with the added edict of like, show some softcore sex. And there's something about that that's just like the Seven Obstructions or whatever that Lars von Trier film was. And I'm just like, I wonder how that played out. But like, as a married man, how do I broach that subject and just be like, I'm going to watch some softcore, but it's just because I'm super interested in it.
Not well, we've actually watched for this podcast a Nakatsu film.
Which one?
It was that series of exploitation films with the lady bikers. Oh my god!
Yeah, that was fucking sweet.
Yeah, that is considered. That's from Nakatsu, who I think is a studio, and those are considered like pink films. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know how different Wet Woman in Wind is from that. But. Yeah,
because that didn't feel that sexy. But well, whatever. Anyway, so check it out. Wet Woman in the Wind. Great name, great title. That sounds like an S. Craig Zoller-esque title.
Yep.
Anyway, so movie.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. Let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and next week when we will 90% sure be watching Lady Bird. Bill Graham.
Woo! You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG, where I will be mentioning all the screeners that I'm drowning in, unfortunately. Hashtag humble brag. But seriously, I will still be trying to make it out to see a lot of these films in theaters because I do truly believe that that's where they are meant to be seen. And you can find me on the Patreon page. If you want to figure out why we kept saying nubile today, that would be a good place to start. Okay.
Yeah. All right. That was the nubile, Bill Graham. Michael Snydell, where can people
find
me?
Sure, you can find me on Twitter. That's where I will also be having daily panic attacks about all the things that I missed this year. And I'll have a review at the film stage this week of a anticipated movie. So look for that.
Anticipated by you or by the world?
By the world.
All right, a worldwide anticipated movie review coming from Michael Snydell. And you can find me twitter.com/BrianJRowan. That's pretty much me everywhere, so check it out. If there's one of those on whatever site you're using, it's probably me. That's a dangerous thing to say. My personal site is dearfilm.net. And of course, I write for thefilmstage.com. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us for our conversation, and tune in next week.